Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Money. Recorded in 1992, Daniel Gressel, PhD, Economics, University of Chicago, Milton Friedman, 1976 Nobel Laureate in Economics, and Robert Hall, PhD, Economics, Stanford University, discuss money, inflation, and monetary policy. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It's seldom that you can date precisely when there's a major change in a human institution, let alone in a monetary institution. But you know, it's an interesting fact that that you can date precisely a really drastic change in the character of the monetary system around the world. And you can date it on August 15th, 1971. That's the date on which Richard Nixon finally ended the supposed agreement by the U.S. government to sell gold for $35 an ounce to foreign governments. And that was the final nail in the coffin of the kind of monetary system that had prevailed from the beginning of time, so far as you can see. That is, all monetary systems before that were commodity systems based on a commodity, whether it was silver or gold or other things. From August 15th, 1971, no national currency in the world is any longer based on a commodity. You know, when people talk about money, they think it means something, but what in the world is the money that people use today?
But even then, the money that we used was not in any meaningful way connected to gold. I mean, it was just paper, as it is today.
It was a long time, you know. Literal commodities were used as money for centuries, for millennia. When you go back, whether you go back to Greece or Rome, they used silver coins or gold coins. Earlier than that, the first recorded kind of money was a mixture of gold and silver. It wasn't a deliberate mixture. It was a mixture that came out of the earth in the form of, what was it they called it? The earliest, it was a king somewhere in Arabia who discovered this amalgam, and that's what they used as money. He was the first one who put a stamp on it and said, this is money, this is to be taken as having a certain value. And as late as the 19th century, I guess most monetary transactions were actually made with coins.
Well, by the 1850s, the most actual transactions were either written with checks, like they are today, or with bills that came from banks.
But at least if you're using bills, they act as if it was a commodity because there was this underlying relationship between the piece of paper and some number of ounces of gold someplace, or some number of weight of commodity someplace. I think what's happened then is, since 1971, is we've had a pure fiat standard where it's just the whim of a government as to what our money's going to be worth.
But we were pretty close to that even before.
Well, a dollar, you know, it used to be, if you took out a dollar bill, it used to say on that dollar bill, the United States of government promises to pay $1. It used to say. Now it doesn't say that.
Hasn't said that for a long time.
Oh, it's not so long. You're young. In my lifetime, it's not so long.
I was a kid when it changed.
So. I'm not sure you were. I think it only changed in about 1960 or...
When they went off silver certificates?
I think so. I think when they finally ended, for a long time, the government had a policy of a fixed price for silver. And they didn't go off that until something like the 1950s or 60s, that purchasing program.
Right.
But now it just says the United States of America, $1. Now, what really gives it some meaning, it said this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Right.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, that's the way the government defines what the unit is.
That means that when I have a debt with someone, I could present that bill, and if they don't receive it, well, they've failed to fulfill their portion.
No,
of the
but
contract.
That's only true if the debt is in dollars.
Is in dollars.
That's right. Sure. That's
the only thing it's really good for is government payment.
Well, no. Wait. No. See, if a contract is written in dollars, the court has to decide, what does the word dollar mean?
Yeah.
Okay, and then Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to decide what the word dollar means. It's just like Article 1 also says that Congress has to decide how long the yard is or how big the gallon is. And one of the things the government does is it decides units of weight, measure, and value. And the dollar is the unit of value, and it's given meaning to that by saying this piece of paper is what we mean by the dollar. Now, what's amazing is that people accept that. You know, this meaning of scrap of paper is taken to have value.
One of the things I find in the course of years of talking about money to lots of people, hardest thing people have to find, the thing they find it hardest to understand, is that literally there are 19 people sitting around a table in Washington who have the power to have twice as many dollars or half as many dollars or 10 times as many dollars.
Okay.
That the people, you know, people think that the number of dollars in existence is somehow determined by some physical or technical or some other rule. The idea that they're just this, who are these 19 people? Seven governors of the Federal Reserve System, plus 12 presidents of Federal Reserve banks. Not all of them have a vote. Only five of them have a vote. But seven governors plus the five bank presidents can vote what to do about the amount of money. And there's absolutely no other control except the indirect control that the Congress could pass a law changing their powers.
Yeah, but the amazing thing about that group is that they regularly contemplate changing the unit of measure. It's as if, remember, there's one other person that we never talk about, which is the director of the National Bureau of Standards, who determines how long the yard is. We never think about changing the length of the yard, but regularly the people you're talking about shrink the dollar, get smaller, a little bit smaller every year. It's as if we had a shrinking yardstick.
Well, it's
amazing that we
not
had
not in terms of the definition. It's still the legal tender.
No,
for
but the purchasing power.
Just back to the original point, we also have an indirect way. If our president causes or acts in such a way that we have higher rates of inflation, we tend to vote them out, which is probably the leading reason Jimmy Carter was thrown out, and also the Labor government was, and Margaret Thatcher came in. So there is some kind of a very tenuous check on their acting.
Oh, I think it's better
acting
than that. I mean, one of the interesting things is not only does the U.S. have this system, but Japan and Germany and many other countries have the system, and it delivers really a remarkably stable currency in spite of the fact that all the elements of instability are there, and yet the performance of the system, especially in the last 10 years in the United States, for example, has really not been bad, in spite of all these
changes. But the interesting thing is, you see that until August 15, 1971, there was at least the pretense that it was not being determined by 12 people,
right,
that it was really being determined somehow or other by the link which it had to gold. If you go really
pretense,
way
though.
Back,
yeah.
It was a...
Well, you correctly called it a pretense.
Oh, it was a pretense. It wasn't a pretense to begin with, if you go back to the... if you go back to what happened when gold was discovered in California in 1848, it was very far from a pretense that the quantity of money was being determined by how much gold there was.
Well, it's not the quantity doesn't matter, it's the value of the money. The value of the money declined when gold became more plentiful.
It declined because there was more of it. The quantity, the value of the money is not unrelated to the quantity of money.
Just argue in favor a little bit of this fiat standard. One of the things that's good about it is society is not really forced to go and take gold out of the ground or silver out of the ground and put it someplace in order to create a money system. So if the government's doing its job correctly, that is having a non-inflationary growth rate of the money supply, then we could have this fiat money, this pieces of paper, instead of the gigantic expenditure of resources on necessary to pull gold out of the ground, being our money stock and save a lot of resources that we could use elsewhere in the economy.
That's an argument I used to make, and I'm not so confident about it anymore. I used to say it's just simply absurd.
Wait, the system's
working
better.
To dig gold out of the ground in South Africa in order to bury it under the ground in New York in the vaults of the Federal Reserve Bank. But since I've observed the operation of this fiat money standard, it isn't costless either. It isn't costless because it introduces so much uncertainty into the world about what's going to happen. You're right.
The point is, in the best of all worlds, savings of resources, if governments do the correct thing from the beginning, it would be the best of all worlds.
But when have you known governments to behave as if it's the best of all worlds?
I've looked at a few of them in my shorter lifetime, and they always do things wrong.
But the U.S. government, in the last 10 years, has delivered a more stable purchasing power of money than we had under the gold standard. Now, I admit that's only a 10-year period.
That depends on what period.
Before that,
last 10 years,
I can name other 10-year periods in which that was true.
Yeah, okay. I'm just saying that it's not, it's not impossible.
You can take a 10-year period, for example.
No, I don't think that's
from 1896 to, really, a 17-year period from about 1898, let's say, to 1914, in which you had a very regular up thing, but it was very stable. It wasn't
stable,
very violent.
Stable inflation. Yeah, that stable period was very inflation. Similar to what we've had in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and you can take a period from about 1922 to 29 when it was very stable horizontally, 7 years.
Right. Some governments do a good job, however, with their monetary policy, and I think something that's interesting is why is the United States, which is where we invented monetarism, where you invented monetarism, why have we done such a bad job, and why have the Japanese done such a good job, and why have the British not even admitted that monetarism is a sensible view?
But hold on for a moment. Have the you take the Japanese, again, you're very time-bound. Until 1973, they did a very lousy job. Until 1973, they were up and down all the time.
Yeah, that's right. There was more price instability in Japan.
Yeah.
Well, since Greenspan has taken over the Fed in my business, which is money management field, we've talked about the Japanization of U.S. monetary policy, where you have the sensation that Alan Greenspan is actually trying to follow the monetary policy that the Japanese have followed in their good period, and he's trying to reverse the monetary policy that the United States followed before he came into office.
But if you take the period, take Japan, go back.
Okay.
73, they had a they changed because inflation had zoomed up to 25%. There was a feeling something had to be done about it. And they did, from then on, have a very good monetary policy until about 1988. And then they went off again.
When the U.S. government essentially...
And it was our fault.
The U.S. government, Jim Baker and his gang, went to the Louvre Accord and said, Japan, you've got to help us do your thing, so we want the yen to go to be devalued. No.
You want the dollar to...
Want
the dollar is too strong.
The dollar's too strong,
Baker's
so
dollar,
help
so.
Us do that. And they have since, by Japanese growth rates...
At the Plaza, no, at the Louvre Agreement, they wanted to support the dollar.
Support the dollar. They wanted to...
That's what caused the Japanese to print so much money.
They went from 8.8 to higher rates of growth rates in their M2 plus CDs, which is what they tend to look at. But now Japanese growth rates of money are down to about 2%, and this is part of the problem that's causing Japan's
Japan
fall
right
in
now
their
is
economy right now.
Remarkable.
Well, similarly, if you take Germany, Germany has done a relatively good job.
Right.
It's interesting. One of the interesting phenomenon to me is how long people's memory is. There's no doubt the reason Germany has done such a good job is in considerable part because from 1918 to 1922, 23, 24, they suffered a tremendous inflation,
spectacular
hyperinflation. Yeah. You know, people don't realize what hyperinflation is. People in the United States complain about prices rising. But in Germany at that time, they paid wages three times a day after breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so people could go out and spend the money before it lost its value.
Well, it was a good idea to buy two beers at once because the price of the second beer went up faster than the beer went flat.
And there are pictures in my textbook where people would walk around with wheelbarrows of money to make their pays.
That's a very extreme. I mean, that's
John Maynard Keynes made that crack once. He said when he was in Russia during this period and he saw a man rushing with a wheelbarrow of money, he said for the first time he knew what velocity of circulation really meant.
One of the interesting things right now going on is just watching some of the things that happen in Russia, where I was recently there and experienced 40%, 50% a month inflation. And this is to people who have known price stability in their mind for years and years and years, and you go from fixed prices, where everything was fixed by the government, to this crazy system where prices are moving at 50% a month. It's left them breathless. They're dumbfounded. They just don't even know how to make any sense out of it. And it's interesting watching these poor countries of Eastern Europe and the ex-Soviet Union undergo these dramatic changes right now. Mm-hmm. Once again, it's because their money doesn't mean anything there. It's just pieces of paper.
Well, if you come back to the United States for a moment and come back to general attitudes about money, I suppose one of the real difficulties about people understanding money is distinguishing, going back to something you were saying, Bob, distinguishing between the number of pieces of paper, the number of units,
right,
and what that number of units will buy, what economists call the nominal amount of money versus the real amount of money. And to an ordinary person, it seems kind of curious. Let's suppose these 19 people sitting around a table suddenly decided that the quantity of money should be increased. And everybody got more money somehow. Let's not ask about the process. Each individual separately would think he was better off. And yet the economy as a whole might be very much worse off. And that's why I think, when you ask the question, why is it that countries have inflation, do something, then almost everybody agrees after the event was a bad thing. I don't believe there's anybody in Argentina who thinks it was a good thing that they had inflation rates of 100, 200% a year. I don't think there's any, there are very few people in the United States who think it was a good thing that during the 1970s, inflation was allowed to go up until in 1980, it was in the neighborhood of 20%. And yet we do it. And that's really a puzzle, isn't it? Why is it?
But it speaks to the more general problem of the failure of government. Governments fail very characteristically in the same direction. They promise too much, they generate too little revenue, and it often, you know, the hyperinflations we talked about are generally related to that phenomenon of the government printing money in desperation to try to honor its spending
policies. It's also, in the case of the U.S. in the 70s, it was probably, I think you've even mentioned this, it's the first round. They didn't know how strong this tiger was that they had unleashed when they got rid of gold back in the early 70s. And that was the first round. Now politicians now know that if you let inflation go up to 20% in the United States, your party's out of power for 15 years.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right.
And this is now the case that those 19 people might say, well, I'm going to give in to the pressure. But the person who's the president says, well, if you give in to the pressure, we're out of power for 20 years. And he's going to be very upset about that.
Is he? Is he? I've just been observing that over the last year, Mr. Bush has been trying to urge the Federal Reserve to go to print more money to ease conditions.
But
let's
be clear, the rate of inflation has declined during that period.
Rate of inflation has declined, but
the president's been saying, let's keep inflation at the 4-5% level where it was before, and now it's dropped to 3%.
I agree that was the wrong thing for him to do. I also agree that the political calculus that he went through in order to allow for an increase in marginal tax rates was an incorrect one, and I don't understand what he gained by doing that either. So if you're saying we have an irrational person who's not maximizing his political support, well, I'll have to agree. I'll accept some of that.
But suppose we're thinking of the public at large here now, of everybody in the United States. Money is, you're right that it's a special example of a more general problem of government failing to achieve what it seeks to do. But it's a particularly important problem. Oh, there's nothing else which, if it goes wrong, does so much harm. And the interesting thing is that you very seldom have seen any structural suggestions for really changing the system in a way which would make money a better servant and a less cruel master.
Well, you and I have both put a lot of persuasive effort into that.
Lots of academic
We've just been unsuccessful, is that what you're saying? Because we've
yes,
tried.
Yes, we have been unsuccessful, absolutely. We haven't been able to persuade the public at large. We haven't been able to persuade the powers that be.
Well, in some sense, it hasn't been that bad.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's not like our school systems or something like that, but it is.
Inflation is not at the top of the list of
It isn't at the moment. No. By the time you bring it down to 3 or 4% a year, which it is now, and of course it's not too easy to measure. What is 3 or 4% a year in what? Some prices are going up, some are going down.
Medical care is going up.
As a computer user,
yes, that's right.
I know that there's been big deflation.
Absolutely. And lots of things.
Automobiles are more expensive in dollars, but they're much cheaper in terms of the number of months you have to work to get one than they ever were.
Right.
And moreover, the quality of them has improved enormously. So it isn't all one way. And yet, it seems to me that for not only in the United States, but elsewhere, that it's fascinating that there's been so little attention to money and what it can do and how much harm it can do when it goes wrong.
And the thing we haven't done is build in any protection against repetition of the disasters of the 1970s or even worse, which could happen. I mean, the federal government is drifting in the direction of a true fiscal emergency sometime in the next 5, 10, 15 years, and that could be accompanied by the kind of a severe inflation emergency that we've not had for a long time. But that's, I think it's, the time to act would be now in terms of trying to make a structural reform.
So far as the public at large is concerned, inflation to them means higher prices. And to them, they look at higher prices as being set by business enterprises. And the most popular explanations of inflation are not those we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The most popular explanations of inflation is that it's greedy businessmen who are pushing up prices, or it's trade unions that are pushing up wages. Those are the most popular explanations.
And inflation tends to bring with it adverse changes in political beliefs about how to run the economy. So it's another reason why.
Part of it is that everybody, whenever you have inflation, everybody loves to have the price of the things he sells go up. Everybody hates to have the price of the things he buys go up. And so whenever you have inflation, you have people who are cheering it on as well as people who are objecting to it.
Yeah, although interestingly, certainly in the United States, the cheering is never very loud. I mean, most the political belief that we shouldn't have inflation and that we should, Dan mentioned this before, that inflation hurt Jimmy Carter politically probably more than any other issue.
But what
so
people don't
realize, our voters really care about inflation, and I think any reasonable politician now understands to deliver not zero inflation, but very stable prices. I don't think you're going to see anything like what happened in the 70s, which is fairly rapid inflation without a real fiscal emergency. I think the danger now is the fiscal emergency, which is the direction we're drifting.
So we won't just kind of make a mistake and end up in inflation. This is going to be our only out, given the magnitude of the fiscal problem that might be building up out there. This is our only out.
Well, it's not clear that past inflations, either in our country or others, have been due to mistakes. They've been due to the fact that it's been a very effective method of taxation. Why did the United States have inflation in the 70s? Because it was a way in which government could spend more money without appearing to raise taxes.
Right, right. But
because the
political system said, no, this actually politically is an expensive way.
It
seems free at first, but it's a politically expensive way of generating revenue, and we're not doing it anymore.
Well, but that's
it's a question of how long that lesson will be learned.
That's right.
Because it seems to be an on-again, off-again process.
Exactly. Well, we have to iterate through that a few times. It's a pendulum.
But I think, Milton, you raised exactly the right question, which is could the country make a structural change now at a time when it's not an inflation emergency that would protect us against that in the future? And I think it's hard. I think that it would require taking monetary policy out of the hands of the 19 politicians that
in
that
terms
run it
of
now.
Excuse me. In terms of who should be doing a change like that, it's not so much the United States. I actually have a little more experience outside of the United States in terms of monetary systems. The countries which suddenly start to undergo extremely rapid rates of economic growth tend to have their wages go up very fast. That's the manifestation of it. And the consumer price index has a large portion of it is composed of things which are a function of how high wages are and how fast they're going up. And we could have a perfectly sensible monetary policy going on in the United States, low rates of inflation. They could fix their exchange rate to our exchange rate, and they could still have very, very high rates of inflation. Right now, for example, Hong Kong, which is following a strategy, something like that, where they have an exchange rate fixed vis-a-vis the US, is undergoing incredibly rapid economic growth. They're fixed to the United States, 3% inflation here. One would think that they should have 3% inflation in Hong Kong. They're having 10% inflation in Hong Kong, 12% inflation in Hong Kong, and it doesn't look like there's anything out of whack. It's really caused by the incredibly rapid rates of economic growth you get in less developed countries. In terms of who should really be spending some political and intellectual energy figuring out what to do about that, I would think it's more the less developed countries who are developing so rapidly.
But it's not clear that in a case like Hong Kong it's a problem. If you look at their tradable goods, if you look at the price index of the goods they export or import, those are going up at about the rate of inflation in the United States,
That's
about
correct.
3 or 4%. But what's going up, there are so many good jobs now opening up across the border in China and southern China, and that the price of haircuts is going up, the price of domestic servants is going up, the price of what you have to pay for rent is going up, but at the same time, everybody's wages are going up so much that there's no real problem involved.
No, but there is a number called the CPI.
There's a
the
number
consumer
called
price
the CPI,
which
right.
is going up, and that right, tends right. to be what people think as their inflation.
And now that raises a real question of you're designing a monetary system for a country like Hong Kong.
Right. I know what I do.
Do you want to keep the CPI constant? What would you do?
Yeah. I would revalue at the rate of U.S. inflation.
Well, but that would just keep the U.S., that would just eliminate would the 3 or 4%.
Right.
But what would it do about the 10 or 12% CPI?
You could revalue it.
That raises a question as a general matter.
Right.
When we talk about inflation, about what it is desirable to keep inflation out of, what should we be talking about? Should we be talking about all goods, including services? Should we be talking about commodities? Should we be talking about hourly wage rate? What should we be talking about as the sort of conceptual price that it would be nice to keep constant? I don't think that's a question that economists have talked about for hundreds of years, and I don't believe there's any answer to it.
Well, I think we've kind of narrowed it to what appears to be the case is that if everything is rising pretty rapidly, say more than 10% a year, that it generates a lot of confusion and a lot of mistakes by consumers. They, for example, the mortgage market begins to break down if you have inflation rates above 10%. Inflation in the 0 to 10% range, it's not so obvious choosing between, say, 0 for the cost of living index and 4%, which is the kind of choice that we Americans are making now. There doesn't seem to be a lot at stake there. It's hard to show that it's hard to find some principles where you can decide between 0 and 4. They're both very small numbers for this purpose. And it seems to me once you get a monetary policy which is delivering price stability in the sense that prices aren't rising more than 4% per year, that you might as well relax.
When you say more than
4% economic problems.
You say more than 4% a year, but stop for a moment. When Richard Nixon, as part of this package which ended the link to gold, imposed price and wage controls in 1971 because prices were rising too rapidly. They were rising at 4.5%.
Well, I would be the last person to endorse what he did.
were concerned. I was concerned at that time with the rate of inflation. There was a lot of widespread concern about the rate of inflation. You know, the interesting thing about human beings is there's nothing they can't get adjusted to. Here in countries like Chile, they're adjusted to 20% a year.
Sure.
And they think it's nothing.
Or 20% a month.
Chile has some very good ways of dealing with that. They get around some of the problems I was talking about.
Yes, they do.
The mortgage market works fine in Chile because they have other ways of handling them.
What's interesting also is the Latin Americans have gotten used to not just 20% a year or 20% a month, but changes between 20% a year and 20% a month.
Yeah, but it's
somehow they know how to calibrate when things are even changing.
But it's been debilitating.
It's a stupid way to spend your energy. It's a total waste of time.
It imposes very high costs.
Argentina, which has been the leading victim of that, Argentinian development, for a lot of different reasons, but partly because of monetary instability, came to a halt when that process began.
Which gets back in some ways to what you originally started the discussion with, is why does someone hold this piece of paper? In the case of Argentina, the peso would be going down in value 10% a month, then 20, then 100% a month, then back to 10. Eventually, people stop using pesos and they start using greenbacks, they start using dollars. So somehow there's this psychology, or there's this cost minimization, I don't know exactly how you want to phrase it, where at some point a monetary system will break down in the country will go to an alternative.
What's interesting is how long that process takes. When we talked about people taking wheelbarrows, I mean, those people in Germany with wheelbarrows could have started transacting in Swiss francs, which are perfectly stable at that time, but they chose to use their own government's currency. It's a fascinating thing because there was nothing
about it. I guess
they're switching from one piece of paper to another piece of paper. When you look at it, you do a chemical analysis. It's the same thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, what happened before, but for the moment, in the case of Germany, not after World War I, but after World War II, which was a slightly different case,
right. And
it shows a different facet of it. Because of the Germany was then occupied by the Americans, the British, and the French. They were able to enforce price control much more effectively than a domestic government could have enforced it. And they had price control, widespread price control.
Yeah.
As a result, you didn't have inflation. You just simply had money not being used. You had barter being traded.
Right.
And it's funny, they used cigarettes as money. They used liquor as money, cognac.
Right.
I've always said it's the most liquid money you've ever had. Have I ever told you my story and my experience with cigarettes in Germany at that time? Shortly after this, I was, in 1950, I was assigned to the, I was in Paris as an advisor to the American Marshall Plan Agency. And my wife and I and our two children in the small Quatre Chevaux drove from Paris to Frankfurt, where I was going to attend a meeting over there. And we started to run out of gas along the way, and there was no gas station around. So I went off and drew up off the Eisenbahn, Autobahn, and went on to a small station and got my car filled with gas, and then I wanted to pay her. Now, as it happened, I had French francs, U.S. dollars, British pounds, but no German marks, because I was supposed to get marks from the U.S. agency in Frankfurt when I got there. And she wouldn't take any of those because she said it wasn't legal. And she said to me, "Haben Sie keine Ware? Haven't you any goods?" And I said, "What kind of goods?" And she said, "Coffee?" And I said, "No, I have no coffee. Cigarettes." So we finally made a deal. I gave her a carton of cigarettes, which I had bought in the PX in Paris for a dollar, and got the gasoline, amount of gasoline, which when I got to Frankfurt, I would be able to get from the US PX for a dollar. So I gave a dollar's worth of cigarettes and got back a dollar's worth of gas. She, in turn, had the gas at the official value of the mark was worth $4. And she regarded the cigarettes as worth $4. So she got $4 worth of cigarettes for $4 gas. It was good for her, good for me. I always used to ask my students, where'd the $3 go? But that shows what you get into.
But that was a deliberate suppression of
absolutely
the monetary system and the price system.
But it's part of the reason why in Germany, ever since World War II, also you've had enormous political pressure on the government to avoid inflation.
Right.
And yet, right today, as a result of the pressures from unification, inflation in Germany is running, what, 5%?
Four and a half percent?
Yeah. Very high for them. They're very great pressure to reduce it. So when you say 4% is okay, 4% is not okay for Germany.
It's not that 4% is okay. I think just combining what you were both saying was you want some prices going down and some prices going up. And in the case of the United States or Germany, where our underlying economic growth is, say, 2% real, probably the inflation should be around 2%. Most people would say they can't tell whether there's inflation or not. If you're in a world of Hong Kong, where you have real wages growing at 10% a year and GNP growing at 10% a year, and you have some prices still going down, but you have all these wages going up, a measured CPI of 4 to 6% will be, quote unquote, okay. Won't look as bad as the 4 to 6% does here.
Well, the other thing is that there's a fair amount of natural noise in inflation. I mean, a good example is that in 1986, the US inflation rate was zero, and it just dropped discontinuously. Well, that was just, it was related to the collapse of oil prices at that time. Similarly, in Germany, you're going to have a blip of inflation as they have with an event like the reunification. And I think it's important that everyone understand that you can't get prices exactly stable. You're always going to have these downward and upward 3 or 4% surprises. And the important thing is to keep it to that and not to have these surprises that generate 10-15% or higher.
Well, the important thing is to have some way of getting discipline on the monetary authorities, which is more effective than we've ever had before, because it seems to me that we have no reason to have any confidence now that 5-10 years from now, inflation in the United States will not be up to $10 a year, 20% a year.
You know, earlier, the markets certainly agree with you on this question.
Of course. If you look at the market, what is the market?
They sit there and they say, we got a problem out here. We don't know what these turkeys are going to do in Washington.
No, you see that very strongly in long-term interest rates. We have
being very hot, much higher.
Ridiculously high long-term interest rates now if the current commitment to monetary policy is correct.
That's right.
But Dan, you said something earlier which I would want to take my exception to, which made it sound like we all believed in monetarism. Because Milton and I have argued for 20 years on this point, and I thought I gradually swung him around. But that's not, controlling the money stock is not the way I would want to see us.
No, but that's a question of definition. We all believe in monetarism in the sense that there's none of us who would say, all of us would agree number one, that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. That number two, inflation under a fiat money system is made in Washington and nowhere else. Number three, that there are many different reasons why you might get inflation. Now, the question of whether the way in which to control, and we would all agree that rapid increases in money supply will produce inflation. We would all agree, I think, that without rapid increases in money supply, you would not get inflation.
Right.
I think that's a series of propositions that every one of us would agree with. Is there any you want to differ with?
Well, there's something I don't want to elaborate, but go on. I don't want to.
All right, now.
I think the thing I'm really going to disagree with is still to come.
Well, no, the question is, how do you get a system under which the quantity of money is moves in moderate ways without producing substantial inflations or substantial deflations?
Right.
How do you avoid episodes like 1929 to 33 when the quantity of money fell a third?
Absolutely.
And we had a major depression.
And the price level fell.
And the price level fell almost in half. How do we avoid situations like 1970s when you had very continuous rapid increases in the money supply and in inflation? Now, there are various ways of doing it. One way I've championed for a long time is to try to put a rule on how rapidly the quantity of money can change. Now, I'm not saying that's an ideal or a perfect rule. It isn't. But at least it would avoid these major differences. You have been in favor of different kinds of rules which would also avoid those differences.
Right.
The key thing in both of your propositions is there's a rule.
That's
You've
right.
got to do something.
You've got
to
rule.
But see, when you start talking about a rule and you start writing down what the rule would be, then I think that making a monetary rule encounters very severe problems because of change in the monetary system, which has generated more competition from credit cards, and all kinds of things have happened that are eroding the position of the paper dollar. So it's hard to set a rule for the paper dollar, whereas what we really want to set the rule for is the result. Which is, in the longer run, simply the inflation rate.
Well, you could set it for the inflation rate. I never have gotten your reaction to the rule that, not the rule, but the method of accountability that Bob Hetzel has proposed, which is that the federal government issued two kinds of bonds, one of which is like the present bond that's paid so many dollars per year, 6%, 10%, whatever it may be, and the other of which is a purchasing power bond, which is adjusted for inflation.
Right.
So that I buy a bond for $1,000 at a, let's say, 4% interest rate. But let's say it's a 10-year bond. If at the end of the 10 years, price level is doubled, I get back $2,000, not $1,000.
Right.
And year by year, instead of getting, let's say, $50, which would be the 5%, I get, if the price has gone up 10%, I get $5.50. If it's gone up 20%, I get $6. And what Bob proposes is that the Treasury should issue two long-term securities identical in every respect, including amounts, of these two kinds. Then the market will price them, and the difference between the interest rate the market puts on the one and on the other will be the market's expectation of inflation.
Right.
And that the Federal Reserve should require to keep, now I add, this is as far as he went. Mm-hmm. He just wanted that as information for the Federal Reserve, so the Federal Reserve would know what it's doing. But I would put on it the additional requirement that the Federal Reserve be required to keep that differential less than 3 percentage points.
Yeah, okay. This is very similar to ideas that I've been pushing for quite a while. You can do it just in terms of the consensus forecast for inflation or for some other measure, some
but
other
nominal
measure.
This is really
this is market-driven.
This is a market-driven.
Well, you've probably heard my most extreme idea, which is that you could issue a type of index debt very similar to that and then declare that type of debt to be the dollar.
No,
the purchasing power of the dollar is guaranteed at all times to be exactly what you want it to be. And that's the ultimate version of this.
Well,
that's, I think, we're far from political acceptance of
we're
what
far from
total
acceptance.
Automatic stabilized dollar.
There's the much more blunt edge instrument, which is what New Zealand does. If you don't, I think it's part of the constitution of the Central Bank of New Zealand, that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, that if you don't keep inflation below a certain level, you're fired, Mr. President of the Central Bank. So it's written in the constitution of the central bank, of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand.
Yeah, the real need is to make the people who are in charge accountable.
Yes.
New Zealand
does that. But we
have to
then state very clearly what it is we expect them to do.
All right. Suppose that's what I would say. If they don't keep the difference between these two interest rates that I talked about less than 3%, for every 0.5% they go over, their pay gets docked 20% or something. You have to have a sanction. We have none now. There's absolutely no cost imposed except public opprobrium. And public opprobrium is so widely distributed among so many guilty people, it doesn't amount to
much. Yeah, but it's not working that badly. I mean,
tell me, who paid a price? What individual, what Federal Reserve official paid a price for the inflation of the 70s?
William Miller?
Yeah, I thought that, I mean, Dan already mentioned that
the
President of the United States.
The president,
paid
but
the
I'm talking
was
about
not reelected. So.
In 1929 to 33, Herbert Hoover paid an enormous price, but the people who ran the Federal Reserve did not.
No, but
and of course Herbert Hoover was led to say in his memoirs that he discovered that the Federal Reserve was a weak reed to lean on in time of trouble. I like the New Zealand plan, whereby Dan Brash, who is the governor of the Bank of New Zealand, has a job under which if he doesn't bring inflation below 3%, he gets fired.
What if it drops below zero? Does he get fired if it begins to go negative?
It's not
that was the problem.
But when I last saw him,
the 1929 disaster could happen in New Zealand.
I saw him recently, and what he was worrying about was that inflation had been coming down faster than it was required to come down, and he was afraid that he was going to get down too low.
Yeah, okay. All
right, so your problem.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that I would say any of these things would be good, provided it makes the people who are responsible, namely the people who run the Federal Reserve Board, those 19 people around the table, you have to make them accountable. And right now, they're not accountable at all.
Well, how do you explain why they're doing such a good job if they're not accountable at all? It seems to me that there's some degree of accountability.
I wouldn't say they're doing such a good job. I think you're exaggerating the goodness of the job. For a brief period now, I would say at most, you could say it's been reasonably good for about 3 or 4 years. Okay. I don't think Mr. Volcker did such a good job.
Miller did a horrible job.
Well, Miller was earlier.
Yeah, but the problem is that one individual has done a good job for a while.
That's right.
What do we know about the future? The answer is not
totally
much.
Agree.
I mean,
we're
at the discretion of one individual doing a good thing.
That's right. And certainly the history of the institution of the Federal Reserve shows very clearly that how vulnerable it is this
moment. I think there's only one conclusion that can be drawn from this. The problem of inflation will remain with us for a long time. Misunderstanding about money will not go away. People will be sitting around 50 years from now the way we are, arguing about what they ought to do with their monetary system. And that, I wish we were going to be able to be here at that time, but we won't. So that's a nice end to our little discussion.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.